It does not preclude, I should say, future progress in an effort to attain a world community. It carries the implicit assumption that preference may be refined as and when circumstances provide. There is therefore no dogmatism about this idea. Cotare's postulate of a preferred world allows for flexibility and expansion. The idea is to build on available networks, and we will talk about this idea in our next meeting. It is this transformation process, which is virtually an ongoing and continuous process, which is significant for world community. It is a concept that goes beyond mere world order. In fact, it encompasses the concept of world order. So, in spite of these big ideas of world community, world order, we have to remember constantly that the central figure is a human being. The world is the world because of the human beings, the individuals that are in it. And we cannot deal with these individuals as though they are mere accidents of faith. And it is the worth of that individual that must be kept in mind when we begin to structure world community, when we begin to construct methods of moving towards the attainment of world community. I would like us to talk about these things. I've thrown them out perhaps in a jumbled way, but I think it would be good to hear what others' views are on these questions. I propose in the next section to look at a specific area of the world. I'm going to draw my illustrations from Africa and try to look at some of these propositions that I've been trying to outline this evening in relation to the realities of the African situation. And then I hope in a final section to look at America, what it has been and done, what it does, and if possible, what directions its current moves are pointing to. Well, let's hear from everybody else. I'd like to respond, first of all, that by saying that I'm merely trying to follow the marching orders that I've been given. You've asked me to talk about America and the Third World. That Third World is a very wide world, and it doesn't exclude anything that I don't necessarily have mentioned tonight. I confine my views to a platform in which that part of the Third World which is most familiar to me is the one from which I picked my illustrations. That's the only reason. I'm not suggesting that it is the only part of the world, the only region of the world that is of significance in the study. So I'm not rejecting anything. I'm not leaving out anything purposely. It's the logistics of the situation that dictate that I must pick and choose. You had something else that you... Well, whether it was little or not is a debatable question. And I'd like to suggest that it wasn't as little as it appeared. I'd like to suggest that one reason for the failure, and this may not explain the entire failure of the process, might have been the fact that it tried to jump a very wide area in a short time. I'm going to suggest here that the only way we can do it is by moving in consistent steps that are clear to the grassroots people, who are finally the people who must decide these questions. I think we are moving away from the age of the elite, however undiscernible the movement away may be. But we are moving from that to the age where we are giving due significance to the grassroots people. And I don't think they understood what was happening. I'm not sure how many of us here, I'm not sure that I understood what was being done. And I think that's the reason for the failure. It was something, it was theory, like all the other theory that has been propounded in the past. Oh, you still have another point.
Why do you think things are changing more to the grassroots level when I'm seeing an increasing... Why do you think things are moving more to the grassroots level? Mm-hmm. And do you think that this kind of movement will be taken seriously by the great world powers in this circumstance?
I think there are a number of occurrences, modern occurrences, that suggest very strongly that the grassroots people are beginning to assume what is rightly their role in life. We are getting away from the idea, which has its roots in the Middle Ages, that there were people born to serve and could never get out of their station in life and that kind of thing. We are moving towards a point, I think, where we are beginning to recognize that without that level of performance, all the things we try are virtual failures. We are witnessing events where the participation at the grassroots level has led to changes, dramatic changes in situations. Vietnam is one case in point. And there are several other examples of that kind. We have a few of them in Africa, where participation at the grassroots level brought change, where nobody saw the possibility of change the day before. The Portuguese colonies were thrown out. I mean, not the colonies, but the colonial system was thrown out when nobody expected that kind of change to take place. And it's because of the persistence of the people at the grassroots level in pursuing a fight which they saw as a necessary fight, without which they could not hope for freedom. It is because of their persistence that this happened. What happened in Portugal and so on, those military men and so on, that was just the catalyst in the situation, really. They had grown fed up of fighting a war which they could not win. And that's because the grassroots people in the colonies were fighting a determined war, which they were going to win at all costs, and they won. So I'm suggesting here that we're getting more and more of that kind of thing. And I'm not going to try to prophesy what's going to happen to the system that was responsible for keeping the grassroots people down. But I am suggesting that they are beginning to take things into their hands, as rightly they should. I don't think it will result in that, or if that happens for a start, I don't think it's going to continue indefinitely. Because, you see, when it happens at the beginning, when you have a nation, for instance, which wins its freedom and the right to self-determination, turning around as the Congo did, and fighting among themselves, you have a situation where you've got to look deeper than the surface to find the reasons for it. And in the Congo, there was definite instigation and support from outside by those who would have preferred the system to remain as it was in the past. We have other examples of that all over the world today. And so the fighting, infighting that you are referring to, is simply the result of that operation. And what I'm suggesting is that when that is realized at the grassroots level, when A, they've won as they did in the Congo, at least in theory, they've won their independence, they'll be very careful, secondly, to retain a measure of freedom among their own small sections and individuals so as to prevent, to close the loopholes which existed in situations like those of the Congo. We see it happening in South America today. Attempts to blast holes through the structure, the new structure, in order to topple it and go back to the old type of situation. That's happening, and it's likely to continue to happen. And if the people at the grassroots level begin to appreciate that that, in fact, is designed to prevent them from exercising the freedom they have fought so hard for, then I think they will think twice about allowing that kind of penetration.
You assume that they'll be able, though, to realize this. I'm just questioning whether or not Haiti would run deep and when it has.
Yes, I think they will. Because so far, the history points to the fact that these interruptions don't result in any gain for the ordinary grassroots people. In the long run, they find themselves back where they were before, with a clique ruling them on behalf of some outside agent. And I think people are beginning to realize that this is happening. And the are beginning to rally round those who led them to attainment of their freedom, to make sure that freedom shall never be lost. This is the way I see it. Somebody else may have a different view, and I hope you won't be shy to express that view. But this is the way I see it.
Move towards a world community when they are systematically oppressed and kept out of the system. And my second question is, what system do you see that can best work for third world communities? And what has worked in the past? What system has worked best in the past?
Well, I hope we'll find time to deal with it this more fully in my next lesson. But I see the grassroots people expanding into a formation which will not tolerate situations like those you have described, where the people are excluded from participation in what is rightly theirs, the decision-making processes, either in the country or in the region. I see that happening. And it is that, I think, which will provide the chance for the grassroots people to structure or reform the present tendencies so that they can become truly representative of the wishes of the people. Now, I realize, of course, that we often make beautiful speeches which don't amount to anything in practice. A noted historian of Cornell once said that if a serious student of history, were to look at the Declaration of Independence, he would come up, or she would come up, with a totally different picture from that which has been painted around that Declaration of Independence. The reasons for it, how it operated, what the results have been, those will be totally different findings from what are traditionally supposed to have been the case. And so, with the kind of attitude that I think is growing, the people are going to look for the basics, the truth, the foundations of things. They're going to look for what people meant behind the things they were saying. And examine that in relation to their own needs at any given time. And if they find that these were mere words, this was mere rhetoric, they're going to throw it out. Because there is indeed very little time for entertaining people by rhetoric and so on. People are facing very serious times. Don't take the results of inflation very lightly. And people are going to ask questions, whether it's in this country or anywhere else. They're going to ask very pertinent questions about what people meant when they stood up on a platform and said this and this and that. I think that's the way I see it. Now, I may be perhaps daydreaming. Some will think I am daydreaming. But I have faith in the inevitability of a grassroots movement in the direction of freedom all over the world.
Dr. Mubarak, as I don't hear a question coming from the other side where the hiss came from, I take it was just rudeness, and I'll ask my question. What my question refers to is, in the late 1960s, the establishment existed in the United States of various black groups, one in particular, the Black Panthers, that espoused philosophy that would have said that blacks and whites could not work together, and they cited the SNCC and other examples to say that it really hadn't worked when white liberals attempted to work with blacks in an effort. Applying that to South Africa, does there exist at this point groups such as the SNCC that were the basis for later on black nationalism, the feeling of such within the United States? And if such, do you see it in future years branching into an all-out people's revolution against the white supremacy?
First of all, I would like to say that I think the term nationalism, black nationalism or white nationalism or whatever, has been misused in many cases. Separatism has come to be regarded as synonymous with nationalism. And you quote examples of how this operated. Now, we have had organizations like that in South Africa, which, as a response to the way the people were treated, have decided that it is no use trying to come together with the oppressor. And therefore, they have sought to go it alone. The Pan-Africanist Congress of South Africa is one example. We know that that attitude led them to the adoption of a term spelled P-O-Q, I don't know if people can pronounce it here, which means simply going it alone. No help from anybody, no alliances with anybody. So we have one eminent example of what you're talking about in South Africa in the form of the Pan-Africanist Congress, which decided on this policy. But I think both here and elsewhere, that has not been successful, nor indeed does it really have a large majority for a long time. It may have a strong following at some point, but not all the time. Because the interests of the people in a country like South Africa have become so intertwined that this is impossible. I mean, the organization, when it was forced underground and came overseas and elsewhere, the same organization became friends and pals with China, with some Eastern European countries, and so on. And what I'm trying to say is, history does not seem to indicate that this policy can go far enough to bring the people out of a bondage. On the other hand, something which I thought you were moving on to. On the other hand, both in this country and in South Africa, talking about the two areas I know, there have been tendencies for those groups, however small, and individuals that have preached the doctrine of a common humanity to be persecuted, taking the same Black Panthers, when they changed their color afterwards and began to operate with an open mind, which accepted people of other groups as allies. The persecution was stepped up, and in fact they were completely destroyed. Which, and of course in South Africa that's been the case. To this day, the South African government regards the African National Congress as poison in the country, precisely because in its famous manifesto, which it signed together with its allies in 1955, the very first sentence says, South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. And that is what the South African government doesn't want to hear. Because you see, when people now begin to get together because they are an oppressed group, rather than because one section is white and the other is black, that can have very serious consequences for those who would like to retain resource monopoly over the land. It can have very serious consequences. And therefore they must be prevented from alliances across color or racial lines. That's been the attitude in South Africa. And any such alliance is ruthlessly crushed in the South African situation. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, thank you very much.
Do you think the South African government will eventually fall?
Will eventually?
Fall?
Yeah. I think it's inevitable. I think the situation has moved to a point where there's no return. It has reached a point of no return. And the liberation movement has indeed committed itself completely to fighting until there is freedom in South Africa, until that charter that I mentioned, from which I quoted just now, becomes a reality in South Africa. And that cannot happen as long as the government continues along its present lines. So it has to face a situation of total destruction of its side. The people are committed to it. There is no coming back. And the actions of the people suggest that they will go to any extreme to crush the current system and its perpetrators. So I think in the long run, that the weight of the people who think that way is going to tell. We are beginning to see people who went along with the white doctrines before, you know, white supremacy doctrine, let me put it that way, beginning to question it and to suggest that some modification is necessary if they are going to survive. And so I think it's moving in the direction when they must either fall or give in. And then, of course, the sophistication that has come into the fighting there is another indication or indicator that things are moving in a direction which was not anticipated by those in power. The answer to that is a difficult one, but I would suggest that a close study be made of those university institutions which were persuaded to give up their investments in South Africa. How do they do it? How much pressure do the students put into that job? And how successful has it been? I think that's a way to go about it. And then, of course, there will have to be adaptations according to Cornell's circumstances, certain things that you will do, which Massachusetts didn't have to do, and vice versa. I think that's the only way that's practical in this situation. It has been done. Therefore, you're not starting something new. Now, how was it done? What were the factors involved, and so on? That is what Cornell students will have to study. And very quickly, too, by the way.
Do you think that student protests have been successful in any way?
Yes, I think they have been. I think Cornell is beginning to feel the pinch itself. I mean, it's not comfortable for the trustees to live perpetually in an environment that is hostile, and they'll have to make the choice. Well, thank you for